This week on Writers, Inc.
I have a very finite amount of time each day to do it, and so I've got to be really on it and motivated and get going.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tumlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I thought I stumbled into a perfect use case for AI. I don't know if I told you guys this, but I'm building an indoor pool. So I hired a designer and he came out and he kind of started sketching out, you know, where the pool can go. And like, we've got, you know, easements, property lines, all this stuff we've got to, you know, kind of factor into it. But he kind of put together a footprint. And he's an older guy who's really good, but he does everything on paper. So like, he doesn't use CAD. He likes to actually draw it all out. So I took a picture of what he had, and just to see what would happen, I fed it into ChatGPT and said, can you turn this into a full on design and provide blueprints? And it's like, oh, absolutely, I could do that. It started asking me all these questions. They came up with, you know, like, we're going to put a waterfall over here. This is the type of pump system you need. This is what you're going to need to heat and cool the room. I spent about an hour just answering questions and just going back and forth with it, just filling in blanks. And I said, okay, I'm finally ready to generate the blueprints. So it like goes off and does, you know, whatever it does, like a little thing was just spinning for like 5 minutes. And then I got a notice back saying my blueprints are ready. And I open them up and like, I look at them, and they look fantastic. But then I look closer and I realized that none of the measurements actually add up. Like, there was one wall that was 26 feet long and the other wall was 46 feet long, but in the picture, the 26 foot wall looked bigger than the 46 foot wall. Right. And like, those kind of mistakes carry through the entire thing.
Can I say how unshocked I am by this?
Yeah, math is supposed to be the one thing that AI can do, like, really well.
Yeah, you would think. And like the other thing that I kept screwing up is like the room, it's kind of a long space. It's 26 feet wide, 48 feet long. And it has to attach to a sunroom that's on my house to like to an existing wall. So that's kind of how we're going to get through the house. Mm-hmm. It kept flipping the entire pool like horizontal instead of vertical and like attaching it to the house in the wrong way. So I eventually gave up. But I mean, what it was good at doing, though, is it created like actual pictures of what the room could look like, which is a good jumping off point, you know, because like ideas I thought I had, like, yeah, not so much for measuring. But you're right. Like the math, like that should be the first thing it's able to do.
There's a guy on Instagram, like social media, who like just makes fun of AI and was just trying to get it to count to 100, like, and it just wouldn't do it. And it was just like... You count 1, 2, 3 like that all the way to 100. And he's like, no, but actually count. And like, it was just so.
Well, isn't that like, there's like the trick of like, if you ask AI how many R's are in strawberry, it'll tell you 2.
Yeah, 2.
Like, yeah. It just like, and you'll break it down. It'll be like, how many R's in the word straw? How many R's in the word berry? And it'll be like, 1. 2. How many in the word strawberry? Sure. 2. Like it just.
Yeah. And then when you call it out, it's like, oh, I see what's happening. You're accidentally spelling the word wrong. Yeah. So, yeah, it's actually 55 R's.
Yeah. Exactly.
The one I like is when the guy says, so I live 150 feet away from the car wash. Should I drive my car to the car wash or should I walk to the car wash? Yeah. And the AI says, you should definitely walk to the car wash. It's only 150 feet. You can do that. And he says, but I need my car there to wash it. Oh, I see what's happening. Yeah, you should carry your car with you when you walk to the car wash.
AI.
This is why I'm not worried about AI taking my job, by the way. So
yeah.
For those of you worried.
Gonna Jedi mind trick this thing.
Yeah.
All right. What is in the news?
Well, in the news, Amazon to bring the UK's first open-air library dedicated exclusively to self-published authors to Victoria Park. Amazon Kindle Direct Publishing is opening the UK's first open-air library dedicated entirely to self-published books, giving visitors a chance to browse and borrow indie titles for free in London's Victoria Park. The pop-up celebrates the 10th anniversary of the Kindle Storyteller Award and will feature books from past winners, as well as successful indie authors like Colleen Hoover and Freda McFadden, who both began their careers through self-publishing. The Kindle Storyteller Award is currently open for entries, offering £20,000 prize, a hometown marketing campaign for the winner, and a special print edition for all shortlisted authors.
Well, this is awesome.
Really cool.
Is this award's only available in the UK though, right? I think I looked at this a long time ago.
Yeah, I believe it's a UK prize.
But I think that U.S. authors can actually enter to win, though.
I don't know.
Because I get little notices for things like this all the time from them. And it's like, hey, change one of your keywords to Kindle Storyteller Award and you'll be entered in the UK store to possibly win this award. I've done it a few times. So I think it is open to everyone, but it's only for the UK store. Someone will probably correct me on that.
But I just think it's cool. And it's just, again, like, you know, putting indie authors out there.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it is like, I mean, it's hard to become a Colleen Hoover, obviously, but like more and more we are starting to see that there are really successful indie authors who are now, like, you know, getting more of that mainstream recognition and moving into the traditional space, which, you know, I think is good. I think it means publishers are realizing that, like, their formulas for what they're looking for aren't working. And so,
yeah,
you're right, Kevin. You do not have to be in the UK to apply. I just looked it up.
I always need to look at that to try to figure out why it's a UK prize, because like Amazon is a US based company, so like there must be a reason why it's a UK thing, like it originated over there, or the idea came from there, like, or that. Something, but yeah, just always seemed a little odd.
Maybe they're just trying to encourage more indie authors to publish over there. I mean, because
maybe that's it. Maybe there's a lot more in the US than there is there.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know. Speaking of Amazon and KDP, though, KDP raises price ceiling for a 70% royalty rate for the first time. Amazon announced that for those using Kindle Direct Publishing, the 70% royalty has expanded from a top price of $9.99 to $12.99, effective July 7th. That is the first increase in price in the price band since 2007. As the Authors Guild notes, this move also brings Amazon closer in line with its competitors. Apple Books and Barnes & Noble Press pay a flat 70% at every price point, and Kobo pays 70% on any ebook priced at $2.99 or above.
Interesting.
So are you going to go in and change your pricing?
No, because I always price my books at reasonable prices, according to the market. So I don't have anything I don't have any paperbacks that should be $9.99 or above, in my opinion, unless I price I have an omnibus collection that was limited to $9.99. So I may move that one up. $12.99 for that would be much more reasonable. So yes. That was a long way around, but yes.
I kind of use the pricing because I think it's different markets, it's different groups, right? So like I've got traditionally published books and those are selling at $12.99, $14.99, you know, somewhere in that range. I publish my my personal stuff at $9.97, but I've also been putting a lot of my co-author titles at lower amounts, like around $5. And I'm grabbing different readers from different groups, you know, because some of these people will pay $5, they won't pay $9. Other ones, you know, so it's all across the board. So I try to use the pricing to just, you know, go out there and grab new readers from segments that may not have been buying under the other pricing models.
Yeah, it's tempting to price up. I already kind of price higher than when I first started, you know, because I used to try to lowball it and get people to buy me because I was cheaper, which I think is a bad strategy for writers. I price at about the same level as most of the traditional publishers put a book out these days. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it goes, because when something like this happens, what will happen is a lot of authors will push their prices up, And that may actually encourage that market. Like if readers become accustomed to paying $10, $12 for a book, then why not? I mean, I can use more money. 70% of $13 is way better than 70% of $7.
It's so interesting, because I do think as a reader, I am reluctant to pay $10 for an ebook.
It's just, that's my experience too.
Yeah. So like for a paperback, that's fine. But like for an ebook, like it definitely, I will wait, particularly for like traditional published books, to go on sale, because I'll always have a sale and you know, grab them then. And I don't know why, but there's like, I don't know, some like mental resistance of like,
what's your price point? What's your top price point?
So $5.99 feels reasonable to me. I won't really flinch at that price point. But I used to shop like the $1.99, $2.99 sales. And that's how I found a lot of some of my favorite books, because they would go on sale like first in a trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like at that point, it's almost just like, sure, I'll buy it. Why not? Like, there's no risk to me at that. I mean, I know it's like $1 or $2, but it feels so low.
Yeah. When they get those sales that are $1.99, and I'm like, I was on the fence about that book, then I'm like, sure, I'll buy it.
Right. Yeah. I'll buy it. And I'll likely read them, because then they're like, oh, that sounded interesting, and I'll buy it. And, but like $5.99 feels pretty good for me for an ebook.
You guys are making me rethink my pricing strategy.
Yeah, I don't even flinch at $9.99, but like, after I do, it feels a little bit weird for an earbook, because I'm like, there's not even any paper. Like, you're just,
I know.
I'm getting an electronic license. I don't know. It's not, I don't even own it. You know, it's weird.
I know. I guess that's why it's weird. It just like $5.99 is like, okay, like that's fine. But like, you start getting up to like $8.99, $9.99, some are like $12.99, $14.99. Yeah. It's like, and then you look on Amazon, and sometimes like a physical copy is cheaper than the ebook. And that is insane.
Yeah. That irks me.
Yeah.
Cause that, like, that just feels like you're giving me the middle finger. That's what that feels like.
Yeah.
But when you see that, is that typically a traditional title or a traditionally published title? That's
Yeah.
Cause I do know they tend to price the, you know, when they come out of the gate, the paperback and the ebook around the same price, because in their mind, they see them both as interchangeable. Mm-hmm.
I guess as a reader,
I do get suckered. Like, lots of times I'll be like, oh, I'm interested in that book, and I'll like try a sample, and then I get hooked, and then I buy it at the $14.99. I'm mad about it, but I do it anyway.
Yeah,
I will only do that. I will do that for the authors that I actually genuinely love their work. Like, you know, if Orson Scott Card or John Grisham or somebody like that comes out with something, I'm okay with that. But often if I'm sampling new books, I'm looking for something well under the $10 range.
Yeah.
If I haven't read the author before and don't know anything about them, unless they've just gotten like stellar press from somebody I really trust, like Jenna said, to go read that book, I'm typically not going to pay more than $10.
Yeah. Lower the price, I feel like the easier it is to convince someone to just hit the buy button. Like, it's just like $3. I mean, sure, why not? Like, there, it just feels like so easy. But the more those dollars start creeping up there, the more you start thinking about it, like, well, what do I really know about this, and is it worth it, and do I really want it? And
honestly, the reason I don't change my price that often is because Amazon doesn't make it very easy, first of all. But the other reason is I literally have so many books that it would take me 2 days to do it all on all the different platforms, you know? So it's better for me to just decide on a price and stick with it and occasionally put one on sale or whatever. But, you know, going through and lowering prices or raising prices, I'm a lot less likely to do that because it would take too much time.
JD, didn't you say that, I don't remember the publisher, but didn't you say that with your 4MK, they did a sale for it and it like spiked your sales on the ebook, that they like did a...
Yeah, no, that's happened a lot of times. Sometimes they've put it in Prime Reading before. They've done it as a Kindle sale thing. And yeah, it lights up the rest of the series. But like, I think I'm just in a weird place because, you know, like I've got a new book coming out with Patterson. I meant to look at it, but I'm guessing the ebook is probably $14.99 or $16.99. Yeah. You know, so like that's kind of the norm for the people that read me. They see a lot of those. I put my own ones at $9.97, which is low compared to the traditional ones. You know, so but they're conditioned, I think, for that particular price point. You know, yeah, a lot of this comes down to conditioning the readers. Like if all of your books are, you know, $5 or less, then you're never going to be able to get away with something higher priced.
Right, right.
That is
That's
true.
Exactly my conundrum.
I like Christine said, if I know and follow the author, like
it's JD's book, I'll pay $14.99 for it.
Yeah, then you're like,
as well,
okay,
you should.
Like, because you know it's going to be good, like, or at least the odds of it being good and worth it are there. But for like, if you're brand new to the author, so I guess maybe the key is price it the way you want to keep it forever and then do sales, maybe. I don't know.
How about this, JD? I'll just give you $7 directly and you can send me like a PDF of it. How's that?
Not a chance.
All right, speaking of nothing having a chance, publishing is a hologram problem and it's growing. Author Robert Moore argues that readers are increasingly buying the idea of a book, its cover, pitch, podcast interviews, and online buzz rather than the book itself. He calls this public-facing version the book's, quote, hologram. He warns that AI is making the problem worse by offering book summaries, chatbots that answer questions about books, and AI-generated discussions that let people consume the main ideas without ever reading the actual text. Moore says the publishing industry may be training people to skip reading altogether, blurring the line between experiencing a book and simply consuming content about it. I'm going to say I think this is maybe more of a nonfiction problem than a fiction problem.
Yeah. I agree. Tim Ferriss just put out a really good essay on this exact thing about how his book sales have steadily declined since ChatGPT came out and why he thinks that happens. Interestingly, he said he wasn't that worried about it, though, because people who want shortcuts, typically they might buy your books, but they're not the ones that like consistently read them and then like follow through on it and like kind of become like a follower for the nonfiction personality. So that was an interesting read for anyone interested in his take.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I think you talked to our upcoming guest about it, but I don't want to spoil that. But yeah, I mean, it's a weird idea, just like that people are consuming what the book is about instead of the book.
I'll give you an example of this. I was listening to a podcast called, I think it's called My First Million. It's all entrepreneurs and they just talk about how they got their first company off the ground.
Yeah.
But they had somebody on there who was talking about this exact same thing and he was researching Ted Turner. So he created a list of books about Ted Turner, which he did with, you know, ChatGPT. He said, give me a list of books about Ted Turner. And then he had ChatGPT create a summary book of those other books. So it gave him like five different books. It created a new book that was, you know, based on those five books, basically pulling facts from all five so that, you know, he didn't have to read five books anymore because there would obviously be a lot of overlapping facts. But he wanted to make sure he got all the data. So it created a new book for him, you know, based on the five books that basically ChatGPT somehow read. And then he, you know, listened to that, I guess some kind of audiobook version of that. Like he had something read it to him. So he didn't read, you know, so those five books never sold. He didn't read the five books. He still got the data out of it. And he did it in far less time than it would have taken to actually go through and, you know, read the books with the highlighter the way we would have traditionally. We would have gone through, we would have, you know, folded corners, we would have made notes. He didn't have to do any of that. That seems to be a growing trend.
Yeah.
Well, you know what this does? It's interesting. I only just thought of this, but nonfiction has had a certain advantage over fiction when it comes to searchability. On, you know, on Amazon, if you go to Amazon, Amazon is really a search engine. If you want to know how to, I don't know, learn to code or whatever, you type that in and it will deliver you those results. But no one can do that when it comes to fiction. Like I can't just go on to Amazon and say, I wouldn't even know what to ask for. I want a book that about, I don't know, Elon Musk becoming a cyborg, and maybe I'd get a hit, but probably not. But nonfiction has always had that advantage. But what this does, unfortunately, is it tamps down that advantage because people aren't going to search for those books anymore. They're just asking for summaries.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've kind of get some of this. I'm thinking back about when I was consuming books about StoryCraft, and I got StoryGrid, which I was like, I don't even know what this is about. And then the podcast was so much more helpful, because it expanded on it and went through those ideas. And it took longer, but it was easier to consume. And I could see like doing summaries for that kind of thing, but I think for fiction, it would be really weird. But I could also see it happening, like people just buying a pretty cover and talking maybe to a chatbot about what it's about. And, you know, people do this, have done this with literary books for years, pretend that they've read them so they can talk to their friends
That's a
about
good
it.
point.
But I mean, I would find that really weird because I want to experience the fiction book, like have the experience of reading it. But I can see an audience that might just want to be social about it or chat about it without actually experiencing the book. It's a weird thing.
I feel like that would be really easy.
This gives me an idea for a great product, Poser.ai.
Oh my God.
You could
I feel like
make
with
your way through
fiction,
every conversation.
it would be really easy to figure out who was doing that though, because like you know when someone's read a book because it's like they'll talk about like some like random quote, right? Or like some obscure side character, or like, you know, it's not usually like, unless it's like a giant plot twist where you're like, oh my God, that blew my mind. Like, usually it's like those smaller, quieter details that like people really like fall in love with a book. And I just feel like that would be really hard to get an AI to like pick up on that nuance. I don't know.
You know, there is a kid somewhere right now, asking his AI, give me three really cool quotes about the Count of Monte Cristo that make it sound like I read it and, will impress other people.
I mean, I guess
Oh,
if you're not
man.
familiar with it, it would work. Like if you're talking to other people who are also like not really, like it would work, but I don't know.
You just made me realize an industry that's got to be taking a huge hit right now, and that's the Cliff Notes guys. They got to be taking a gut punch.
Well, this is in a roundabout way, this is actually working its way through the court system because Google created these AI summaries now that show up at the top of every search result. They're getting sued by all the underlying companies because now people aren't clicking through anymore and they're not generating that ad revenue that they were getting before. So that's going to work its way through the courts, and it's very possible that the practice may be, might be outlawed and they might not be able to do it anymore.
I just got thinking, does anyone here ever watch IT Crowd? This was a while ago. It was a British show.
What I'm
I used to watch
curious
it,
Yeah, and do
is
you remember there was that sports site for like lying about watching sports to your friend? It was like Blackball. Like, did you
That's
see that
right.
ludicrous display? And you'd have like three quotes about sports you could say to your gonna turn into this.
That's
So
funny.
the only thing I don't understand is they initially got all this stuff by stealing the books, which all these court cases have now said like you can't do that anymore. So how can an AI company keep up on new releases if you're not allowed to steal the books anymore? Like, because right, like if you upload a book into your chat history, isn't it supposed to be closed now? Like it's not supposed to be used to train the model. So like how could I don't
You
understand
have to
how
turn that off
illegal.
manually, by the way.
Yeah, but legally, I mean, I know like they don't really pay attention to the law, but if the lawsuits came back and said you weren't allowed to steal it just because someone illegally uploads it into their own chat and they leave that turned on, isn't that still illegal for them to train the model on it?
Questions for a different age, Jenna.
Questions for an attorney.
I mean, okay. I guess like that's why I'm just like, I don't really understand how this is going to be like a long-term future thing because like technically it should be illegal.
I'm
We'll
pretty
see.
sure that in the terms of service we're agreeing we're allowing them to use anything that we key in there unless we do what Kevin said, which is drill through all the settings and find that one toggle that they don't want you to find and turn it off.
It's deeply buried too, by the way.
I'm sure it is.
But if it's illegal for you to do something, it can't just make it like default legal for them, right? I mean, I guess that, like you said, a question for an attorney, but like if I illegally do something, like other people can't legally now benefit from that illegal act.
You would hope not.
But you're giving them permission to utilize the content. It's no different than Google. Like every Google search, every Gmail that you send, every Google Doc you create, all of that stuff is usable by Google, unless you opt out. And I don't know that they even give you a way to opt out because they're letting you use their product for free in order to gain that.
But I guess I'm asking if the book was stolen, like if you download an illegal PDF and upload it into ChatGPT,
Yeah.
like
Don't
do
know.
two
Yeah, I don't
wrongs
know.
make a right?
I think you're gonna have to try it and then let us know what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No way.
Send us. They have prison pen pal programs that you can use to let us know what happened. All right, that's it for the news.
JD, who's up this week?
This week, we've got Stig Abell coming on. Stig's a British journalist, broadcaster, and author. He's currently co-hosting the Times Radio Breakfast Show and previously worked for BBC Radio. His latest novel is called A Twist in the River, book four of his Jake Jackson series, and it released earlier this year. Here he is, Stig Abell.
Well, I am happy to chat with well, we didn't really get a chance to chat beforehand, but I'm sure we're going to be fast friends, Stig. So,
I feel that already. I feel very strong vibes about that.
Stig. So we're going to be talking today about your new book, A Twist in the River. When does that book release?
It's out where I am in London at the minute and in Canada and Australia, but in the US it comes out on the 23rd of June.
What US has to get it last? What are
I
we?
don't know.
What's
I don't understand publishing even. I've been doing it. I don't. Why does publishing take so long? I
don't
write
know.
these things and then they disappear for sort of 12, 14, 15 months and then they reappear again. I've got no concept of why it takes so
Don't
long to
even
get
remember
from.
what the book's about by the time it comes back.
Yeah, I have to read it again. I have to read it again.
So what how long is it how long did it take to write the book?
I'm a very, and I think I don't say this with any great sense of pride. I'm a very fast writer because I love doing it so much. And once I get going, I'm a real momentum writer. So I probably write 1500 words a day and I write every day. And so it's probably 12 weeks is about to take, yeah,
Okay.
3 months, 3 months, I think. And I realize that,
Three
you should,
months.
as an artist, be sitting in a garret somewhere and have only single words bleeding out of you that you scratch on a
Right.
piece of paper. But I'm
Sur
not that
yeah.
person.
Surviving on nothing but scotch and stale bread.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not that guy.
What is your writing process? 1500 words a day, is that your like daily target? What you
I try
usually aim
to. I
for?
mean, I have this strange life because my day job, I present a breakfast radio show. So I
Okay.
get up at 2:30 in the morning and I get driven to a studio and then I work till about 11 in the morning. And then I start writing on the train home. And then my kids come back from school about 4. And so between sort of the journey home and 4, that's the only time I have to write. And
Yeah.
so I don't have a desk. I just have a computer. And then wherever I can go where it's quiet, I go and write. And again, I'm sure there's people who only write, it's their only job. And their biggest complaint is they have too much time and it's hard to focus. The virtue, I try and make a virtue of the necessity here. I have a very finite amount of time each day to do it. And so I've got to be really on it and motivated and get going. And I feel that the joy I have for it sort of helps me get going. And then once I'm going, I'm happy to be doing it.
Yeah. Does it take you? Do you feel like you? I mean, is it a struggle? Is it an actual struggle to get moving?
I think if I've prepared it properly, not so much. I don't think I'm the best in the world at plotting. I think plotting comes hard to me a bit. And so, also, the other thing, if at 2:30 in the morning I get driven to work and I'm in the back of a car for 40 minutes in the pitch black, feeling wretched, that's quite a good time to do plotting. So I sometimes arrive at work and scrawl a note to myself while I've suddenly worked something out. So if I've done my thinking properly, I put some music on. I always listen to music as I'm writing, and I actually put a playlist at the back of the book. So if you see the book, there's the
Oh,
playlist
okay.
that I'm listening to as I'm writing, which I also sort of secrete into the book as well. So my characters are listening to the music I'm listening to, and then the readers can listen to the same music as well. There's a playlist in the back of the book.
My friend, that is an idea I'm definitely stealing.
Now go for it. No, I'd love it. Because also, I kind of. One of my favorite things about reading is the fact that that two people are kind of fused when they're not geographically or chronologically linked. And actually, when you put a piece of music on, both listen to the same piece of music or read the same text, it's this sort of fusing. So I love, no, do it, take it. I love the idea of contextual reading when you're reading and people are kind of knowing what else is going on around you.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's like a bridge across space and time. You're
actually, exactly.
You're able to get into the same rhythm, the same headspace. Yeah. Have you done that with all your books?
Yeah, I did it. I'm not sure I had the confidence to put it in the first one. This is the fourth one of the series, but it's definitely in the preceding two. Because I like I said, I don't have a desk, and because I'm writing on the move a lot.
Yeah.
I actually think listening to music is a way of me, in a sort of Pavlovian fashion, indicating to my brain, oh, you're writing now. And I think that helps me sort of get focused a little bit. So I listen to often classical music. I make a joke in the book because my guy, who's the detective in the book, he reads a lot of detective books. And so he knows he should be listening to jazz.
Yeah.
Jazz is what all good hard-boiled detectives should be listening to. And he doesn't really like jazz. So in this book, he meets someone who tries to get him into jazz. And she gives him a sort of a listening list, which makes it into my listening list as well.
That's very interesting. Does that come from your radio background? This the connection to music, or
I don't know. I tell you where it comes from. When I was a kid, I used to do homework at the dining room table, and my dad used to do his work. He was a businessman, and he used to do his work with me on a Sunday morning, and we would listen to 70s and 80s rock music together.
Yeah.
And so we'd listen to like Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. And that kind of formed my taste in lots of ways. And of course, I'm 46 now, so I've basically become my dad. But actually, the idea of music being an accompaniment to work, I think I've just had from that point onwards, from a child.
Yeah. So, all right. Let's go back then. Since you brought up some of your origin here, where did this start for you? Like, why did you decide you were going to start writing? When did that happen?
Yeah, so I've written a couple of nonfiction books, sort of explainer books about Britain, and then a book about reading as well. And I was supposed to be writing a third nonfiction book, which was impossible. I pitched it foolishly. It's completely beyond my abilities. And the conceit for the book was, how does an art student answer the most difficult scientific questions in the universe? So how do you have the sort of the explainer of all explainers for where the world comes from and stuff like that, but through the eyes of someone who is an art student to his very core, which I thought was quite fun. But of course, it requires a vast amount of research and anyway, I wasn't writing that book. And then COVID happened, and I started just writing a book for my wife to read in the bath in the evening. And so I didn't have a contract. I didn't have anything really. And I used to write, and my daughter was 7 at that point, or probably 4 at that point. And I'd sit in the evening and do her hair, and we'd watch telly, and my wife would read in the bath, and I'd write 1,500 words for her to read in the bath every day. And so I've loved books my whole life. Books have sort of saved my life at various points. And so I always loved the idea of novels. And so I just wrote this really for the joy of writing. And then I finished it, and I had an agent for my nonfiction book. And I said, well, I've written this thing. You can read it. If you hate it, we'll never mention it again. And she passed it around, and someone bought 2 books on the back of it, and that's got me going on it. But the point was, the writing in the beginning was for the pleasure of it all.
That's that sounds idyllic. You've got
You
just decided one day, I'm just going to write something for my wife to read in the bath.
Yeah,
yeah. So,
but I also loved it. You know, I loved detective fiction growing up, and also, you know, COVID happened, and I started thinking about. So I live in London. Mm-hmm. And you'll remember this at the time. Lots of people were talking about what it is to be living in an urban versus a rural environment, how important green spaces were, how important connection was, you know, solitude versus loneliness, the intrusion of technology, all these sort of things bubbling around. So I started writing a novel about a guy who inherited a house in the middle of nowhere in the British countryside, where there's no technology possible. There's no internet connection. There's no TV. There's no radio. And I throw him into this sort of rural idyll in a place where there's no technology, and try and work out how much he can resist the modern world and how much the modern world grabs him and shakes him and won't let go, which in many ways is the great question we're all wrestling with in some form or other. So there was a kind of philosophical itch I was trying to scratch at the same time, I think.
Yeah. Well, especially 2020, we were kind of in a position where technology was our lifeline to the rest of the world. So to write something that, you know, pulls someone out of that environment, yeah, that's an interesting twist.
And also, I, and in subsequent to that, I think certainly the news story narrative that we have in this country, I'm sure it's the same in America, is that technology, I think, has loomed ever more as this pernicious influence, yeah, in our lives. And the rise of AI, about which I'm very gloomy, and the like. Although we are, as you say, reliant on it. So it's a very difficult thing, technology. And the reason I like my guy Jake in this place, because he escapes technology where he lives. But of course, when he gets involved in investigating murders, technology pops back up again as well. And so right. He gets to try and resist it and succumb to it in the same way that we all do.
Yeah. So he's not a Luddite. He's just resistant.
Yeah, I'm a Luddite. I'm actually quite a proud Luddite, I think. I try not to be. Yeah. But I do, like I said, because I do 4 hours of news every day, where a considerable chunk is social media is ruining our kids. We have no attention span. No one's reading books anymore. And by the way, if you work in a white collar job, AI is coming for you. And my eldest is now 17. And I got no concept of what jobs will be available for her when she turns 21.
Right.
I think Ludditism starts to look rather attractive in those circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. I've had my eye on some Amish barns here in the Pennsylvania area.
And what actually can be more proudly Luddite, really, than a book? An actual physical, wonderful, tactile piece of 17th century technology.
It's like it becomes a sort of quiet rebellion that you hold in your hand. You've got 300 pages of rebellion against technology.
Yeah, and look, I don't mind. You know, I think Kindles are a wonderful invention in lots of respects. I love audio books for people who might struggle with reading or might want to fit it into their lifestyle more. So you can't fight against all of this stuff. Yeah. But one of my great pleasures in life is, as you say, 300 pages of rebellion.
Yeah. So what do you count as sort of inspiration for the stuff that you love to write? What is it that feeds that?
I think probably began with detective fiction in a variety of forms. So I remember as a kid reading Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. And actually there's a bit in Sherlock Holmes, which is a direct inspiration for all of this, because there's a moment in one of the stories of Sherlock Holmes where he's on a train with Watson. And they're driving through the countryside and Watson is saying how beautiful and pretty it all is. And Sherlock Holmes turns to him and say, actually, if you could, even the darkest, most fetid corner of a city is comparatively safe compared to these sort of lonely homesteads where who knows what's happening beneath the cover of darkness. And, you know, and I came up with this idea in my mind, which he more or less says, which is that, you know, in the countryside, no one can hear you scream.
Yeah.
So I've always loved detective fiction, starting with Sherlock Holmes. I've always loved tactile fiction that talks about sensations and tastes and smells and feelings. And so putting my guy somewhere where the teams with that. And so both American and British detective fiction got me going. And then really all of literature thereafter. I did an English degree in like I said, I spend my life reading books. And so the love of books, I think, got me writing. I think there's no getting away from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's something to that, because we love, there's stories that we love to read again and again. And then there's stories we wish we were seeing on the page. And that ends up forcing a lot of us to go sit in front of something.
Yeah. Well,
there's a keyboard.
There's a great quote by Benjamin Disraeli, the 19th century, Prime Minister here, where he said, every time I want to read a book, I write one. And so, which isn't quite true, of course. I mean, do you like to reread a book?
I do, yeah. I like to reread.
See, my wife hates it. I love rereading. And in fact, again, the reason why I like writing series fiction is some of my fondest moments of reading are returning to books and worlds and characters that I'm familiar with. I think with a series you can build that up, but also just the idea of, you know, going back to you know, I've read some books tens, hundreds of times. Yeah. And, you know, there's an American series I love. Do you know John D. McDonald, who wrote the Travis McGee series? Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of him in my mind, you know, fighting against the modern world, lives in a beautiful, interesting place, his amazing boat in Florida. But yeah, there's loads of series of I find series fiction such a joy, where you stumble into it on book five and then you realize, or book 25, right, and you realize, oh my God, I've got months of reading to come, is one of the great experiences in life, I think.
Yeah. You don't feel that upset. I get readers who get mad when they come across my series, like, you know, 12 books in or something. If
I like it. I mean, what I like is, because in some ways the first one is the hardest one, because you've got to build, there's a lot of just workaday building you've got to do. You've got That's to explain right. where everyone is. You've got yeah. to move into place. You've got to literally sort of construct the house they live in and the landscape they live in and all that stuff. And in some ways, series really get going on book two. So I'm very fond of stumbling into a series and then starting from the beginning once I already know who everyone is.
Yeah, I like that. Do you find, all right, well, let me ask you this about your series then, because sometimes I'll notice like character drift. There's a difference between character growth.
Yeah,
you know, we saw this character grow over 10 books or whatever. But sometimes the beginning, the character is very different than the rest of the series. How did you manage to avoid that problem? And how'd you do that?
My biggest problem, or I've got many problems, but one of my biggest problems is I really like my characters. I don't know if you feel mm-hmm. this. So I have to have rows with the publisher who I kind of just want nice things to happen to them. And I realize it's crime fiction. And so I think probably my first, Jake Jackson's the name of my detective. And in the first book, he meets this woman who's a vet. And so he goes away from the city. He's had a failed marriage and he meets this local vet and they start to fall in love. And I just really love that relationship. And actually, most of the time when I get emails from readers, they really like that relationship. They like nice things happening to them and they like the idea of love. Right. But often my editors will say, you need to put a bit more grit in all of this.
Right, right.
And so I probably idealized Jake, my guy, a little too much. And as we've gone along, I've had to put a little bit more burden on his shoulders and make him get tempted by things he shouldn't be tempted by. And the Edenic aspect of it all probably has shifted from the first book to the fourth one. And actually, I've written, the fifth one is completely finished, and I've written a first draft of the sixth one. So I'm well ahead of the game on this. And I'm a very annoying author in that I would just happily sit and write and then write another one and another one. And you'll know this, publishers don't want that. They want it from some people. They'd love it from Agatha Christie or whatever. They don't want it from me sending them emails. Yeah, I've got another book done. So again, I've got to be careful that I don't idealize them too much, I think is one way I've stopped the drift. So I've had to put a bit of nettle in all of this.
Yeah. You know, the problem is I'm the same way, by the way. I like my characters a lot, so I don't really want them to go through hell every book. You know, I'm thinking of writing, you know, Dan Kotler goes on vacation or something.
Yeah. There's an argument, you know, that nothing bad. I'd love it. Because again, the incidental pleasures of books don't rest on the battle of good and evil to me. So I think crime fiction has the battle of good and evil at its core. Of course it does. But my favorite bits of a book are the incidental pleasures.
Yeah.
And to do that, I think, you know, it's Kurt Vonnegut who said, you've got to have someone to root for. Otherwise, you're just, your character's just shouting out of an open window.
Right.
And I think, I find characters to root for really important.
Yeah.
You know, and if you dislike a character, I also, if you read John Updike's, you know, the rabbit books. Have you ever read John Updike's book? Yeah. You know how awful his son Nelson is? It's so brilliantly written, but his son is such a dick. I hate him so much. He's so rude and thankless, graceless and ungrateful and whiny. And he's so brilliantly written. But it slightly tempers my enjoyment of this magisterial one of the great novel series of all time. It slightly annoys me because he's too much of an awful character.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you do to make sure your characters aren't flat on the page?
I try and see them physically in my mind, and I try and hear them in my mind. And actually, for example, by the time I got to the fourth one, I've built a sort of team around Jake. And there's this character I discovered in the second book. She's a woman called Martha, who's my favorite character in the whole thing. And again, one of those people that people, when I talk to readers, they like. She had her legs blown off in a terrorist incident. So she used to work in the security services. She now writes cozy fiction for a living. But she's this sort of ex-spy, really. And she's incredibly leery, incredibly mordant, and sarcastic. She smokes weed the whole time because she's in pain. And she's this presence that sort of blips up on a computer screen to offer caustic advice. And I really like, I've sort of stumbled into her. She was just a bit part in the second one. And then she's going to be in every, as long as I get to write this series, she's going to be a major figure in it. And I hope that I just try and find people with interesting characteristics and quirks and oddities and eccentricities, and that stops them becoming flat.
Yeah. How does that apply to your protagonist? I mean, he's going to get all the adventure in every book, but there can kind of be a, I don't know, things can kind of slow down in that part when it comes to character development. How do you make sure he's always growing?
I think the central predicament I've put him in is endless, because I think a version of it is, as I said, the one we're all facing, which is, on the one hand, he would love to jettison the world and live this sort of hermitic, beautiful, rural lifestyle. Yeah. And yet, that means no family. It means no entanglement. It actually means, if you're a detective, never being the hero to solve a mystery where you play center stage. And in many ways, that's the same, I think, moral quandary we're all in, that at one level, we should reject a lot of the trappings of the modern world, and yet we're completely enticed, almost to the point of being overwhelmed by them. And so I think he gets to play out the sort of moral battle of the age each time, which is to say, how much, you know, I'm very much struck by the notion that for all of human history until 20 years ago, when you closed the front door, the world was outside and you were inside.
Right.
And then 20 years ago, we decided to just abandon that completely. And the concept of front doors are obsolescent. The world comes at you. Its tentacles sort of creep through everything and grab you. And so the battle against that is in many ways the battle of modern existence. And I think he gets to do that at a certain level in every adventure. I find that interesting.
Are you aiming to make that kind of commentary? I mean, is that an overt decision on your part?
I think because I spend my whole time talking about the news, it's intrinsic to who I am. So I spend a lot of my time debating the issues of the day, and therefore it's all I do. And I think it's kind of intrinsic to who I am, a sort of chatter and a prodder and a poker and a try to think about things. So that's probably intrinsic to who I am. And so it's things like, so this book, Twist in the River, it started, the inspiration for it came from a news story. So a woman went missing in England, and I was very struck by the fact that no one could find her for a week. She went missing in the river, in a river, in the middle of nowhere. And you'd think, Britain's a very small country, we're a tiny island, you'd think mysteries wouldn't really happen here because we're all living on top of one another. But it did. And then all sorts of things followed from that. There were self-appointed experts in the media saying they'd find her. There was this new phenomenon of true crime YouTubers who descended on this tiny village and annoyed the hell out of everyone by just trying to get content out of this tragedy of a community. And so that type of the issue of how the modern world infiltrates everything was, again, it was just there in you almost can't have a modern crime story without that being part of it, I don't think, really.
Right, yeah.
So I was very struck by that. And so I took that as a job. I mean, nothing else that followed is any way related to what happened to that woman who I think just drowned while swimming. But it made me think about the smallness of the country versus how hard it is to have a mystery, and yet mysteries still happen.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of the whole podcaster YouTube thing when it comes to that?
Yeah. I started my career working. I used to deal with complaints against journalists was how I started my career when I was young. And I'm very struck by the fact that journalists get a bad reputation with some justification for going after a story relentlessly and not always morally. But at least there's a framework by which journalism traditionally functions, even more so in America, I think, than in the UK. I think there's a danger in amateurs who, if your stock in trade is the click, and you just need likes and clicks and the serotonin rush of that, I think that's a dangerous place to be telling stories about people's lives. Now, some people do it beautifully in podcasts and YouTube. But I think the desire to get a sugary hit out of someone's tragedy doesn't necessarily make for very good storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. Has that perspective influenced the way you approach your storytelling?
Yeah, I think anyone with a conscience tries to do that. I mean, you don't always get it right. And it's not always possible, actually. I mean, the other thing I find interesting about podcasts is I know from talking to publishers here that podcasts are killing the nonfiction book. So there is a crisis.
Oh, well, I can see it.
Yeah, so there's a crisis in nonfiction in this country, I'm sure probably in America, where you could spend, $30 for a beautifully written history of the American Civil War.
Right.
Or you could listen for free to a podcast of the historian doing in 10, 30 minute episodes, which you can listen while you drive or jog or whatever for nothing.
Yeah.
So are you spending your $30 and trying to carve out time to sit in a quiet room and read where the whole world is shouting at you? Or are you going to stick it in your headphones for free and wander about the place listening to it? And so again, this is my Ludditism again striking, but technology is going to take away a lot of the pleasure of the book, I think. And you're starting to see that in all sorts of areas.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm seeing a march towards analog right now.
I mean,
I'm seeing a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. I hope so.
Who can say though? You know, things change so rapidly. New technologies come along, disrupt everything. Who knows?
My fear is kind of that books are the vinyl of the future. That there'll be some people who love, there's some people who love vinyl. And you always get these news stories, vinyl's up 150% this year.
That's right.
But it's 150% of four. So it's gone to
that's
nine.
What I was about to say. Yeah. You can double vinyl sales when you're only selling one a year.
Yeah, exactly. And so my slight fear is that the things that we love, those books, will be loved by the vinyl fans.
Yeah.
But that's not everybody.
No, it's not. I'm seeing.
Good for you. Listen,
there's hope.
Let me inject that into my veins. That's fine.
Take this from me, my heart to your soul.
Yeah, bless you.
So, all right. Well, as we kind of wrap up, you've talked a bit about what the book is, what it's about. Do you want to talk? Can you talk at all about what's coming up?
I can do. I mean, so the fifth one, which will be out in a year's time. I had an idea to do this when there's a very famous golden age of detective fiction book, a novelist called Josephine Tay. Have you ever heard of her? There's Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers, who most people have heard of. And there's two more who aren't that famous. One is called Josephine Tay. Anyway, she wrote a book called The Daughter of Time, where her detective broke his leg and then decided to solve the mystery of the princes in the tower. So he solved a historical mystery from his bed. So it was a modern detective novel written in the 50s about a murder that allegedly took place in the 15th century. Okay. And so what I thought would be fun, although it was a fair traveling, was to have Jake and his the love of his life, Livia, stuck in a hospital, at least partially, and then asked by someone in their village to solve a crime from the past. So they're solving a fallen woman crime from the Victorian period. At the same time as stuff's going on in their life, a modern day colleague of his has gone rogue and is coming after him. But the crime story is really a question of set in 1858 about this woman who seemed to kill herself And did she do that because she was forced to? Was she murdered? What happened to her when she, something bad seemingly happened to her in 1858? And so Jake, because he's stuck in a health situation, is solving a historical crime.
So it's like a locked room mystery, but the detective's the one locked in the room.
Exactly. Yes, great. That's a good way of that. Yeah. So I don't know how it will go down. It was great fun to write. So it's a little bit of a historical novel, a little bit of a modern novel, and it's the people who hopefully people have grown to like trying to solve a crime from 150 years ago.
I already look forward to it. I'm going to have to catch up on your whole catalog, but...
But bless you. I mean, the first one is Death Under a Little Sky, and that was out, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is the fourth one, Twist and River. I mean, you can, if you don't want to read all that other stuff, you can just read this one. This one just sits on its own as a tale, and you'll catch up pretty quickly.
Of course. But, Gotta read the whole back catalog.
If you like this one, my gift to you is that there's three others to read. And
there you go. You
know, and that's one of the, I remember, Sue Grafton books James Lee Burke or, any of these series. Michael Connelly, obviously a great example of it. You stumble into book five and there's some other ones to read.
Excellent. All right. Well, where can people find more about you and your work?
I've slightly jettisoned X, but I'm on Instagram, this Dig Able, and you can always drop me a note there. If you happen to read one of these books, I love talking books with anyone. I've loved talking books with you. It's been a great privilege, but anyone ever wants to talk about anything like that, you can just send me a message on Instagram. I'm happy to chat.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. What a pleasure to talk to you.
So... Stig talked about writing within tight time constraints instead of waiting for the perfect conditions. So I have sometimes put artificial deadlines on myself just to push my limits. Do you guys do things like that? I mean, do you find that it's that you work better with constraints than with a wide open schedule?
If I have the time, I'll fill it. Also, I need someone to drive me into work so I can plot in the backseat. That's
I do it all the time. So I always, every time I start a book, I always tell Scrivener that it's going to be 80,000 words, and then I backtrack from there. And I figure out whatever, I typically do 2,000 to 3,000 words a day. So I set myself a goal of 2,000. And I use that to create whatever my deadline is. And then it'll actually tell you if you're on pace for that or not. And if I fall behind, then I end up doing more words. But I basically create a deadline. It's not a real deadline. Like, I don't have a deadline on the book, from a publishing standpoint. Yeah. But it's one that I'm using to just kind of drive myself to the writing table.
Yeah. Yeah, I do that too. In fact, that's pretty much my method. You pretty much outlined it. I typically say, this book's going to be 80,000 or 100,000. And that you can work the formula to figure out. And if you want to take days off, by the way, you have to add that in there too.
Yeah. I tell Christine my goals, and if I meet them, she sends me a surprise.
I do. I send her presents in the mail.
Well, like a puppy?
No, there was a tumbler with a whale that spouts when you drink out of it.
Yeah.
I forget. I have another one in mind. I'm waiting for you to finish.
I feel like I'm missing out on a lot of cool stuff by not chatting with you two more. Yeah. I feel like I should
We get up to stuff.
You got a hoodie.
I got a hoodie once. Yeah, that was cool.
That's right. I send people a
hoodie. The t-shirt you sent me that USP. Was one of them.
Unlikable female protagonist shirt.
I get compliments every time I wear that shirt out. So you are missing out, Kevin, is the long and short.
If you need deadlines, I will send you ridiculous stuff in the mail if you meet them. So just let me know.
There we go. Now we know.
Perfect.
So one of the more interesting ideas that came out of this was that every story carries an underlying philosophical question. In this one, it was, our relationship with technology. But do you think, should novels wrestle with those, quote, big questions? Should that be an overt thing that we do in the books?
Yeah. I mean, that comes down to theme. Sometimes. And I think, whether you intend on it or not. I do think that the novels that tend to resonate with a wide readership have a theme to them. Even thrillers, like there's usually, you know, themes of, you know, good versus evil or what makes someone do thing or, you know, there's, I think that that always just, if you're dealing with like why, if why is putting your plot forward, like there's going to be some questions that you're asking why about.
But I go into every book, you know, trying not to teach, you know, like a moral lesson. But at the same time, I think because your character has to go through some kind of growth, that means they have to learn a moral lesson. So even if you're not intentionally out there trying to plot one throughout the book, because your character is going through that change, it's there in the background, whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah, I do think that's important. I don't think that, you know, I don't think that we should beat a reader over the head with like, you need to learn this lesson. But I do think, yeah, if a character is learning and growing, there's going to be something that they're learning and growing.
Yeah, I don't even think like you have to answer the lesson. I think you can just pose the questions and then, you know.
Yeah.
I like that better. I like it better when there's am not talked to, but like, hey, think about this.
I don't want to be preached to. I don't like message books, you know, like the messages we're ruining our ecology or whatever. I let me pick that up on my own. And I think that that probably happens more than the intentional underlying philosophy. Like you, right. I've had plenty of readers, or I've been on interviews, like podcast interviews, where people have asked me about, you know, this theme that they picked up on. And literally in that interview is the first time I ever even considered that theme, but I roll with it because I'm like, great. Yeah, I
obviously
totally intended
that.
I
did that on purpose.
I'm a master of the craft. So this is probably going to be our last question because we've kind of run over, but Stig, he admits that he likes his characters so much that his editors have to remind him to make them suffer.
Yes.
So how important is it for you to make your characters suffer? Do they have to suffer? Yes. Can't we have some mercy for
No.
God's sake?
Unfortunately, I think it comes down to like, so like what JD said, your character has to learn a lesson. And I think for all of us that have been like, alive on this planet in the year of our Lord 2026, like growth hurts and is painful. Like it's never easy, right? Like it's never fun. It doesn't ever feel good, but you have to go through it.
Yeah. And like, we don't like growth and we don't like change. We have to be forced.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, even in like, you know, cozier books or low stakes books, growth is still painful. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just the way it has to be. Otherwise,
unfortunately, kind of we must make our characters suffer.
Yes.
This is how I know that God is writing a book about my life.
All right. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got John Dingell coming on. John is the author of the critically acclaimed and multi-award-nominated Gus Wheeler FBI series. He's back with book number 3, titled Before the Devil Knows, about two teenagers brutally murdered in the forests of northern Maine. I think it releases July 29th. So, John Dingell.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.